Robin Atkins. Time for another Monster Chiller Horror Theater. Oh! 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 And tonight, we really have a frightening movie for you tonight, kids. This is really going to be scary. I'm not kidding you this time. This movie is called Blood-Sucking Monkeys from West Mifflin, Pennsylvania. And it's really good, so I'm not going to waste any more time. Let's take a look at this movie. It's really gonna scare the daylights out of you. Ooh. Let's take a look at the film.
What?
Well, there's no movie. There's no movie.
Welcome, everybody, to our Halloween episode of Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and my spooky pal to the left of me is Jason.
Good evening.
Good evening. I was going to do something, but I would just come off sounding like a dentist or something.
Can you do a? Can you give me a? Being Canadian, can you give me a Count Floyd howling at the moon?
I can't, because I don't think I could reach that octave.
Can we just kick this off by saying, what's going on with Joe Flaherty? What's he doing these days?
Not enough.
No kidding.
And if we ever do the SCTV show, you're going to find out that I value Joe Flaherty above all else. I
mean, you know what he is? He is like the it's like, for the longest time in the Python group, it really was Cleese as the standout. Everyone kind of went Cleese. It's not quite the same thing, but Palin was so good at what he did, at the subtlety of it, that, you know, Cleese got more of the attention because he was better known at the time. And, of course, he stood out like a tree. So in the SCTV group, it's like everyone else was doing much bigger stuff.
Broader stuff.
But Flaherty was like the Jeff Bridges of the group. Like, he was so good at what he did, you didn't notice.
There's something he does, and I can never find it, but it still makes me giggle when I think about it, which is somebody put on some weight. Flaherty's Count Floyd is a masterpiece.
His Count Floyd, Guy Caballero, his Kirk Douglas, I think, is the best thing he ever did.
There's a lot of characters he does, like, you know, and I'm going to go deep, like Duard Weiss, and, you know, just weird. He just commits to the bit. It's no longer an over the, like, you know, Saturday Night Live, everyone's so broad.
Yeah.
His characters are all kind of like, well, I believe that guy would walk down the street.
Well,
so funny about him.
That's the who are the two, Earl Camembert and
Floyd Robertson. By the way,
Floyd Robertson and Earl Camembert.
By the way, there's a news anchor in Canada named Lloyd Robertson. So when
they would do those things, neither of them were being very big and broad. But certainly Eugene Levy was more of the character than – Flaherty played it pretty straight.
Yeah, and of course, the beauty of the Floyd Robertson is Count Floyd is Floyd Robertson. And he's just got a piece of shoe polish on his head for the widow's peak. And he's got a dime store cape. And he's always scamming the kids. And this is a beautiful – I know this sounds like we're trailing off.
Yes,
but
this will all make sense.
Our subject matter is – this is a beautiful segue. This is the most on-topic start to anything we've ever done.
It only took us 87 episodes to finally figure it out.
And anyways, I also want to put this out there. If anybody knows Joe Flaherty or can get me in touch, I want to make a Count Floyd figure. I really, really do.
I'll go further. If anyone out there knows Joe Flaherty, I want to be his friend.
Yeah.
So if someone can get me his info, I will go over to his house.
There is a guy that I'm disappointed doesn't work more.
He just – it's like almost all of them. Andrea Martin pops up in stuff. I mean, we all know what happened to Moranis. Everybody sort of, you know, Harold Ramis, rest in peace. But like Joe Flaherty just kind of disappeared.
Well, he was in Freaks and Geeks.
He was in Freaks and Geeks, but that was – I hate to break it to you. Freaks and Geeks was 1999.
And to be honest with you, I don't – when we started getting all these cable channels, there was this show and there – it was like a – it was a sketch comedy show produced in Canada and it looked very cheap. And I was so saddened to see Guy Caballero in it because Flaherty was on it and it was just beneath him.
Oh.
And, you know, it was a low-budget show. The sound was bad, and I just remember thinking, "This guy should be on in big-budget movies to this day."
You know? Do you know the show Spaced?
Yes. Well, yeah.
Okay. Simon Pegg,
Nick Frost,
Jessica Stevenson, yep. Nick Frost, Edgar Wright, etc. Well, Brian, the artist that lives upstairs, Brian
Payne. Yeah.
Yeah. That's Mark Heap.
Yeah.
Mark Heap, everything I've ever seen Mark Heap in, he is phenomenal. Like, he is just fearless. But the thing is, you know, the part of Brian isn't nearly as showy or as in your face as the rest of the characters on the show. But he's, I think, the best character. And his everything he does is so – sometimes it's so subtle and it's so – and I've seen him do it on Brass Eye, Happiness, another show that he did, Green Wing, this crazy out there character. He's so good at what he does. I think sometimes guys like that, you take for granted how good they are at what they're doing because they're not the big heavy guy or they're not the funny hairdo or whatever. And that's kind of, I think, what Flaherty was on that show and everything that he did. And it's also hard to know where to put those guys sometimes because they're not the wacky guy at the front, you know?
Yeah, and maybe that's it. But, you know, he does pop up in things, but he's definitely not as big as he was or as big as he should be, I think.
But Brian, please tell me, why are we trailing off talking about Count Floyd and Joe Flaherty?
Well, because our subject today is horror comedies.
It is?
Yes.
And hey, what a coincidence.
Don't pretend that you didn't pick this one.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I thought this was all about the Slinky.
We were going to do Godzilla. We taped Godzilla. It got deleted.
Why would you tell people that you did that?
Because when they listen to the Godzilla one we patched together next month, and it says Happy Halloween, everybody, they'll get it.
I told you, this Godzilla one is going to be the Eric Stoltz cut of Back to the Future. This is going to be the Eric Stoltz mixing in with Michael J. Fox cut of Pod Stallions.
Yeah, well, I'm just really sad they're never going to hear your song.
What song?
You know, thanks for going for that bit.
Oh, sorry, Ryan, I don't remember the stuff we talk about. I could very well have gone off and made a song.
Yes, it was your version of Danny Boy.
Oh, yes. My version of Danny Boy sung by Jeff Bridges. Yes, I remember that. Well, maybe next time.
Yep. Okay, so horror comedy is something that's definitely huge to me because as a kid that really sparked my interest in monsters. And mm-hmm. I'll get to that, but I thought we should work chronologically.
Well, yes, I think we should. And I think before we even get this kicked off, my 2 cents on this is I feel that the horror comedy, the spooky thing, it depends on what your mileage is or what your flavor is or whatever. But you know, certain things we're going to talk about are far more goofy and far more silly and far more comedy. But the ones that are sort of on that line of like, ooh, that was a little scary. Actually, that character's kind of creepy. Or there's a hint of sort of menace or dark comedy or something. Those things that work are very few and far between. I think there are more horror comedy or spooky comedy type concept things that fail, far more that fail.
Yeah.
Than the ones that work. And so it's
either they go too far into the scary,
yep,
or they go too far into the, you know, mugging and goofy
winking at the audience.
And it doesn't work on either level.
Yeah.
Shocks and laughs I think go together like peanut butter and chocolate, but you can give too much of either. It's a real tightrope.
And I know exactly where to go with that when we get there. I'll tell you exactly what I think. Mm-hmm. But let's get back to that eventually. But you kick it off. Tell me what's
the genre. The genre is older than my grandparents. I mean, it started out in the 20s. The first horror comedy reference is a movie called Haunted Spooks. Haven't seen it. But, you know, it was a lot of haunted house comedies throughout the 20s. And, of course, The Cat and the Canary comes up in a lot of books. I've never seen The Cat and the Canary. I'm going to turn in my Monster Kid badge. In the 30s, I think the most famous horror comedy would have to be The Old Dark House. It is famously a film that stars James Whale and is directed by James Whale. It stars Boris Karloff. That one is very famous. Have you heard of The Old Dark House? Have you seen it?
No, neither.
No way.
No, I haven't. No,
I have not seen it in a very long time.
Now, is it funny for the time? Funny? Is it funny like Marx Brothers? Funny like timeless kind of funny? Does it work?
You know what? It's been a long time since I've seen it. You know, I don't find a lot of 30s comedies hysterically funny.
Right.
So, I really couldn't tell. I would let the audience delve into that. But Karloff plays the creepy butler in the film named Morgan. And if you saw a picture of him, you'd go, oh, yeah, I know who that is. And Karloff also was involved in a very famous play, and I'm going to have to – sorry.
Was it Glengarry Glen Ross?
Yes, it was Glengarry Glen Ross. He's going to take Brass Bowl.
Who would you cast? Who would you cast in Glengarry Glen Ross in the 30s with the horror stars? I'd make Karloff the Pacino character.
Okay, yeah, I could see that.
Peter Lorre maybe the Jack Lemmon character, because he's, you know, he's or maybe he's the Kevin Spacey.
Dwight Frye would be the Jack Lemmon character.
Yes, perfect.
You
nailed it. Nailed it.
Yeah.
And the Kevin Spacey would probably be Charles Laughton. and the Ed Harris, of course, would have to be Bella. Because in the play and in the film, that's the biggest confrontation is between Ed Harris's character and Al Pacino's character. So imagine Bella and Boris going head to head using
right.
And Gary dialogue. Right. There you go.
You know what? Now that you've wonderfully got me to search out the name of the play that was killing me, which is Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen the film?
Years ago, yes.
And the Peter Lorre is in the film, isn't he? He's the surgeon who does the surgery on the guy that he ends up looking like Karloff.
Yeah, and of course, the Broadway play. Karloff played Karloff, right?
No, so did he?
Yes, yeah, that was the joke of the play.
Oh, no.
He looked like Boris Karloff. And of course, the film, they couldn't get Karloff out of his Broadway contract to play the character that was written for him.
Oh, my God. I never knew that. I just assumed that it was a – I knew it was a play, but I just assumed that they'd get someone in makeup or something.
Yeah, the 40s was ripe with horror comedies. The big one that I can think – some of the big ones I can think of are The Ghost Breakers with Bob Hope.
The Hope and Crosby or just Hope?
Just Hope and Paulette Goddard.
Got it. Okay.
Who was, 1940s.
Yes.
One of the hottest women of the 1940s. Sure. There was also
– She's no Myrna Loy. She's one of my favorites.
Okay. that means I don't know. You know, and then they've got a film in 41 that's not too politically correct these days, but my friends and I used to love it, which was called King of the Zombies. Have you ever seen that?
That kind of rings a bell.
It stars a guy by the name of Mantan Moreland, who, you know, was one of the early black comic performers. And it's
Mantan?
Yeah, yeah. He's really funny in the movie. He really does steal the show. But it's not a high point for the African Americans, but it is a very clever and funny performance, you know. But yeah, it's
so let me jump in here, and because it wouldn't be the show without me jumping in and
of course.
Going.
Of
so I think I don't mean to be psychoanalytical here, but I think that we can all kind of agree that when an audience is in a scary movie, whether it be a scare thing like a Jaws kind of thing, or you know the paranormal thing. and they and people scream and they jump back and they're freaked out for those 2 seconds, pretty across the board, they instantly start to laugh afterwards.
Yeah.
There's something that connects that shock thing with the thing. So
that goes for action too. You know, the Marvel movies are successful because they balance that whole lapse with laughs with action.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. They get real deep, but then they have a few laughs.
Yep.
And you know, I love it.
Yeah, no, I do too. And I think that it's a testament to how popular the horror movies were in the 30s that somebody said, well, let's add some, you know, and I think, see, I get what you're saying with all the early stuff. I think the real sort of ground zero of such things had to be the Abbott and Costello stuff, right?
Well, yeah, I think what had happened was the Universal Monsters had their heyday, and then they kind of had their heyday again. They became sort of a series of B pictures after a while. And I think, as I recall, the original Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein was going to be a third house of film originally. You know, I don't know if you're too familiar with the Monster Rally films, but you've got House of Dracula, House of Frankenstein. These were popular, but they aren't great. They really, really aren't great. I love them. I watch them. You know, you get all the monsters together, and it's a little tenuous as to why they're all together. But they're kind of fun. But they were going to do a third one of those, and I think Abbott and Costello's film career wasn't going so hot. So they kind of – somebody got the idea, let's put these two together. And it made magic. And, you know, Universal did some really, really great things. One thing is they got Bela Lugosi back as Dracula. I don't know if you know this, but he hadn't played Dracula since the Todd Browning film.
Right, 31?
Yeah, and they've been using – they used Lon Chaney Jr. They used John Carradine. And I know I'm critical of Lugosi's Dracula, like the Browning film, but nobody holds a candle to him during that era.
No.
He was brilliant in the role. And it's really nice that in the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, he's Dracula again.
Is it true, though, that he was considered or he was offered the part of the Frankenstein's monster?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's really fresh in my mind because I was just listening to Gilbert Gottfried has a podcast.
Thank God.
It is wonderful. It is okay. Absolutely wonderful.
Wait. Does he sound like an old Jewish comedian in the Catskills?
Well, you know, he doesn't sound like the way you think he'd sound, but he's actually a terrific, pensive interviewer, and this guy knows his monsters and he knows his
'60s
television.
That's
and,
cool.
You know, he had Sarah Karloff and Bela Lugosi Jr. on, and one of the things they talked about was yes, Lugosi was cast in an early version of Frankenstein. It is not the James Whale production that came out. And in the initial version of it, I don't think there was a lot for the monster to do.
Okay.
And the monster looked more like a golem.
Oh.
So whatever makeup they tested them. There's no footage, if there is, wow, please enlighten me. But it just – he went, nah, I don't want to do this. There's no point in this part. Okay. So it's not fair to say that he turned down – the Karloff Frankenstein, he didn't. He turned down an early draft that just probably had him just going, walking around. And that wasn't, you know, he was a romantic lead.
Right.
So.
Yeah. He's a handsome fella.
Yeah. And it probably made sense for him to turn it down. It wasn't, you know, some people have made out like it was a big ego thing. But, you know, Lugosi's son, who is Bela Lugosi Jr., adamant that his dad turned down a much different film.
Who I know this is the elephant in the room here, but like if anyone's ever seen he, that man, what's his name again? His son?
Bela Lugosi Jr. What a hard to remember name.
Why'd they call him that?
Why not?
Where'd the name come from? Junior, I'd never seen him in person. I never met him.
I've met him.
And I was at a Monster Palooza and like turned around and I went, what the? Looked at the sign and I went, I think I even texted you and said, holy cats.
Yeah.
That is eerie, not to be cliche, but that is really eerie how much he looks like his father.
He looks like his dad, but he looks like him, but he also looks like somebody who didn't go through as much hardship, you know? Like he's aged well.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. Probably. It might be the
And I'm not speaking just to Lugosi, but people had hard times back then, you know?
Yeah, I remember them. It was tough.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You're immortal, are you?
All right, let's go to Abbott and Costello. So Abbott and Costello, the first one is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yes.
Which is a documentary. Not a lot of people know that. Shot in real time.
Yep.
But it was so successful, and it is, I think, truly one of the best comedies ever.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's the night before Halloween, so that means that it is the furthest away you could possibly get to the next time I watch it. Or, sorry, from the last time I watched it, because I watch it every Halloween while I answer the door for trick-or-treaters. And it's usually around the time that Frankenstein catches on fire that the kids come home and count their candy.
Okay.
And then I eat.
Spoilers about the end of the film, by the way.
Oh, yeah, because if you haven't seen that. it's a magical film.
It really is.
You get Lon Chaney Jr. You get Abbott and Costello in their prime. You get Lugosi. There's no Karloff Frankenstein. You get Glenn Strange, which is okay. I love the look of Glenn Strange as Frankenstein, but he's basically a stuntman walking around. But it's a fun film. It's got a lot of laughs. I have nothing to say but good things about that movie.
Well, okay, so and it was a success, obviously.
It was a huge hit, and it spawned many sequels.
Well, Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman?
No, the Wolfman, that was the last for the Wolfman, Frankenstein, and Dracula. And if you recall, at the end, Vincent Price as the Invisible Man.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was it? So let's just, we don't have to have them chronologically, but it was Abbott and Costello met Frankenstein.
Meet the killer Boris Karloff in 1949.
Okay. So how many of Abbott and Costello Meet Monster ones were there in total?
There were five.
Oh, geez. They had a good run, huh?
They had a great
run. Did they meet the creature?
They did not, but that would have been awesome. But well, you know, once you take the piss out, it's kind of over. And I don't think that the Universal monsters were ever scary after that.
Well, see, that's the thing, and I can't believe I found this segue and managed to actually include it. But do you remember the that's the thing, these sorts of things with those sorts of characters and those sorts of that sort of a spurt here and there, it has to be a brief and then it goes away for a while and it comes back, because otherwise it starts to be that's what you associate with. Like when everyone thinks of Elvis, I guarantee you 99% of people, when they think of Elvis, they're thinking of Vegas Elvis with all the gear and a big belly and, bananas. But really, I think Elvis, I think of, pre-war Elvis or, pre-army Elvis or the 68 comeback special. But that's the thing that's in people's minds. So you remember that time a while back that Seth Green and Seinrich were going to do a similar to Robot Chicken kind of thing, but just in the universe of Star Wars, which meant that every episode was going to be taking the piss out of Star Wars. And it was going on back and forth. And finally, they said no. And Seth Green's statement, I thought, was really something. He said, we're dangerously close to having a couple of generations now, possibly, of kids or people whose first exposure to Star Wars and its universe might be the show that we do. And I think that's dangerous because if it becomes better known as a parody or a joke or a piss-up, sending it up or something, then it starts to diminish what the thing was.
Yeah,
and every now and then you got to bring Frankenstein back, Frankenstein's master as the monster or Dracula or whatever. So having said that, and that actually is not a bad segue, Abbott and Costello, what do we see like in the 50s? To me, that kind of whole monster era, there was a lot of stuff like I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Oh yeah, well it was the Atomics took over.
Right.
For the most part. And
were those played as for laughs, like intentional laughs, like comedies type
atomic
things?
Atomic movies, no. But I think when you got into Dracula, the Abbott and Costello era is pre-TV, right?
Yeah.
So we did, they met Boris Karloff. Then in 51, they met the Invisible Man. 53, they meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I love.
Okay.
I really love that film. And then 55, they meet the Mummy. And boy, is the... is the air out of the tires by this point.
Oh, boy.
Lame. It's not even a real mummy. It's done. So then, you know, you hit the 50s and that shock theater thing where kids are watching monster movies again.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you know, you got AIP cranking out these things, teens digging monsters, and it's half laughs, half serious, and of course, late 50s, Hammer, and Hammer's making the Universal stuff look corny, right?
Yes.
Because they've got color and blood and breasts.
They were hardcore.
And you know, Christopher Lee is biting people in the neck, and there's blood coming out of his mouth, like... You know, it just made the Universal stuff look stodgy and comedic.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got Bela. He was doing comedies like Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla and My Son the Vampire. You know, he was just jobbing.
Right.
And you've got Karloff. Karloff never stopped working.
He had a heroin addict to kind of – I mean, a heroin habit to
– Karloff?
Keep going. I'm sorry.
It was a straight edge.
Karloff worked like right till the end.
He never lost his. He worked. He was a. I think he was one of those guys who just took jobs because he knew starvation.
Would you agree that as a horror star, being best known as a horror star, would you say he is? You say the word Karloff.
Yeah.
And that's where everybody goes. They go to that. It's like Bogart or whatever. It becomes and I think so. And isn't it interesting that the two guys, Karloff, Lugosi, both accents, both very, very distinctive voices. Isn't it interesting that like Karloff's got the unbelievable accent, distinctive way of speaking. And Lugosi, I think everyone after Lugosi went bleh, bleh. Everything was the accent that he had.
Well, you know, you say that, but yeah, people do the blah blah for Dracula, even though I don't think he does it. And people often do that kind of like when they do Frankenstein, they go and they put their arms up. That wasn't Karloff at all. That was
no. I think of like some people think I'm a monster.
Yeah, you know,
like kind of that. Yeah, everyone does that like it could be anything else that he did, that distinctive, incredibly distinctive voice that he had.
Yeah, he was able to parody himself and still go back to making horror comedy. He was able, you know, he went all over the place. I mean, one of his last films is Mad Monster Party.
Yeah, it is.
And that is a beautiful horror comedy for children. And again, it's a complete taking a piss out of his horror career. And it's
but now let's... Let's get there because the 60s becomes – see, I think of the 60s as kind of – and I'm probably wrong. You'll know this better than I do – as sort of the dawn of the double feature horror host on local station kind of thing.
No, I think that was the late 50s, but it was definitely massively predominant in the 1960s certain.
You know, and Goulardi was
– Goulardi was Ernie Anderson who
– Late Ernie Anderson.
You sent me that wonderful outtakes of Ernie Anderson. If you guys don't know who Ernie Anderson is, he's famous for being the ABC guy who would say, "Tonight on the Love Boat."
Tonight on the Love Boat.
He had a voice. It was amazing.
Which was a perennial, was "Tonight, Moonraker." And then parental discretion is advised.
Yeah, I think they parodied him on Family Guy where he could he could go on "Tonight on Hunter," you know, "Stephanie is in trouble." And then, you know, he could do that.
And then Jack's having trouble with the other ladies on Three's Company.
Please don't write in and say those are two different networks, we know.
There you go.
What I was going to say was the reason I know who Anderson was in the 60s, Anderson actually started in comedy with Tim Conway. They're both from Ohio.
That's right. And Anderson's son is?
P.T. Anderson, is he not?
Yeah, that's Ernie Anderson's kid.
Yeah, he was.
He
was Ohio famous for being Goulardi.
And that, I'm sorry, but that's how. Just real weird sidebar. You know the Colonel that's in Boogie Nights.
Yeah, he's Thundar.
Robert Ridgely, yeah. Thundar, and Flash Gordon, of course, in the King in the syndicate of the. Filmation, my mouth doesn't work. The Filmation Flash Gordon thing. That's why P.T. Anderson would put Ridgely in those movies because Ridgely knew Ernie Anderson right. from all the comedy and the voiceover stuff that they would do.
That's funny. Goulardi was famous for hosting monster movies, getting into the movies. He would jump in pre-Mystery Science Theater and sometimes run around. And he also had a, you know, he would blow up Aurora model kits. Kids would send in their Aurora model kits and he'd blow them up with firecrackers.
Okay,
chaos.
But let me jump in.
Yeah.
Why, how did the whole, like, I mean, if you're going to do a double feature of something like that, I get the monster thing. I get maybe it's a count or whatever else. Why? How did it all of a sudden turn into wacky? Is that the whole, like, the era of the beach movies and the wackiness and Rat Fink and all those things that are just kind of – it's almost like beatnik stuff. Like, let's just – yeah, let's be goofy or whatever. And it's not really making fun of this stuff. It's still making it cool. But why do you think that they – those hosts all became kind of goofy? And
I think you had to go there. I think, you know, like a lot of them did the good evening, I'm sure. But, you know, the earliest ones I can think of are folks like Vampira and the very still alive Zachary.
Zachary
yeah. is a lovely man who I think he's 95 now.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. I've met him several times. He used to drive himself to Chiller Theaters, so I'd run into him in the parking garage.
That's cool.
But, you know, they just they were entertainers.
And, right.
You know, what are you going to do? You're going to make the kids laugh. The movies are schlocky half the time. So you have fun with it. And that's what drew their personalities. A lot of these guys were also the ones who hosted the cartoon shows in the morning.
Excuse me.
We didn't have fandom. Like, you had to, like, let's go deeper. Famous Monsters was just full of bad puns and humor.
Oh. Absolutely, and again, it goes back to the marriage of these things and people. To, you know, but the funny thing about the hosts like that you're talking about, then it got to a point where they were so popular, people were tuning in to see them and their antics or appearances or what have you.
Oh yeah,
you know, even more than why they were tuning in.
I recently watched a documentary that was about horror hosts in one state, I think Maryland, and there was like 20 guys.
Wow.
And it was crazy, you know, and it was a great documentary. I'd like to see it again, actually. But so, yeah, that's definitely of the era. And we've, you know, that's also the time, I think, when one of the most influential horror comedies came out in 1960, which was Roger Corman's Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
Which it was a cheapie shot in a few days. Nobody expected anything of it. Of course, it inspired a musical, which inspired a movie. And I'm sure that's, you know, I think there was even a cartoon series at one time, all based on this.
After the 86 film that Frank Oz directed with Rick Moranis.
Yeah. It's crazy how far that went. And then, you know.
It was never my thing. I didn't think it was dumb or waste of time or anything. It is really, really bizarre for the time. I mean, even for now, if you tried to pitch that thing to make that movie,
I think it only could get made because. Sorry, I got a little feedback there. I think it could only get made at the time because I think they did it in 5 days. They did it on sets from another movie.
Yeah,
and,
that's
know,
right.
It's one of those things like, let's throw this together too.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Corman was also responsible for The Raven, which is one of the first.
Karloff and is Nicholson in that one?
Nicholson's in Little Shop and in The Raven.
Is that the only other – yeah, you're right. No, he's an officer, right? He's the military guy?
In The Little Shop, he's a perv who likes getting stuff.
No, in The Raven, is he like a military guy or something?
He's Peter Lorre's son.
He's Peter Lorre's son.
Yeah.
You know, can I just digress for a minute how much I like Peter Lorre? Have you – I'm assuming you've seen some Bogart movies like Casablanca and things like that?
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines in any movie ever, and it's the biggest – people out there, if you think you're getting it from the man or anyone's giving you a hard time or whatever, think about this. Peter Lorre's character – we're setting up who Rick is. We're setting up who Peter Lorre is. First conversation he's having with Rick, Rick is barely even looking at him. Not even looking at him. He's doing stuff, writing stuff down. And Peter Lorre says at some point, can I just assume – he's about to talk and then he stops and said, Rick, may I just assume that you despise me? And Bogart says, well, I suppose if I gave you any thought, I might. It's one of the greatest FUs in movie. But Lorre was so – he only could have been sort of – you know, he couldn't necessarily do anything. But it's interesting that the faces that we're talking about, the Peter Lorres and the Karloffs and the Lugosis, these character faces –
Yeah, they're very storied faces. There's a terrible
voices too. All three of those people we're talking about, completely different voices. And as soon as you hear them, you know who that is. That's a completely.
You want a really funny story?
Sure.
About faces and how Peter Lorre should feel insulted. There's a terrible episode of Route 66. I think it was called Eye of Newt or something like that.
Huh.
It's got Chaney, Karloff, and Peter Lorre in it.
Okay.
They all at the end appear in their classic horror makeup.
Okay.
Karloff has the crappiest $1.95 Frankenstein makeup on you've ever seen.
Oh my God.
Chaney's Wolfman was also purchased by at a dollar store.
Spencer's.
And Spencer's. and Peter Lorre's just got a top hat.
Oh, Peter. Why? Because who did they think he was?
You know what? He was in some horror.
Yeah.
But he was never a monster. But they just put a bloody top hat on the guy. He had to. He just had to feel like crap after that, you know?
He was boy, we're really getting off topic. But, you know, the original – you know, the Rat Pack. Or the Rat Pack originally, before the Rat Pack, before Frank and Sammy and, you know, Dean and everybody else, it was Bogart and Peter Lorre, and Frank was the next generation, and they were friends, but that's where the Rat Pack name came from. And so Bogart and Peter Lorre were lifelong friends, and always went out drinking and burned the city down, kind of thing.
Interesting.
So okay, so let's get up to the 60s now. So now we've got the horror stuff, we've got the stuff on TV.
You got Corman producing, you know,
Corman producing the stuff, but low budget, and people dig horror, and they dig. Then you get the gimmicky stuff,
stuff like the Ghost of Mr. Chicken.
Oh, have you ever seen the movie Matinee, the Joe Dante?
Oh, absolutely. We should get to that. That's a wonderful send up of Castle.
It's done with so much love, and it's done so well. And no one makes fun of that character or what he's trying to do. People loved that stuff.
Movie should have done a lot better.
It's a really good movie. Joe Dante did that. Good.
Go ahead. The one I want to bring up is Lemon Grove Kids Meet the Monsters. It's something you probably haven't seen. It's something I own on VHS, like a legitimate copy of, which is a guy by the name of Ray Dennis Steckler, who made a lot of cheap films in the 60s and 70s. He used to go by the name of Cash Flag.
Right.
He looked exactly like Hunts Hall from the Bowery Boys. And the Bowery Boys, you know, they made some cheapo horror movies. So he made the Lemon Grove Kids shorts in his backyard with his neighbors. And basically they were remakes of Bowery Boy movies. They're cheap. They're weird. They're trippy. Seek them out. I love them. I just absolutely love them. I remember I left the tape at a friend's house, and he said, I don't know if it's a good thing, but my kids have been watching it, and they kind of dig it, you know. But they're really kind of odd films. But I also wanted to go to the next big horror comedy of the 60s, which is Carry On Screaming.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh! I can't believe I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great one. That's a great one.
Well, you know, it's not a great one.
Is that the one where there's at least one, maybe two jokes that are kind of sexual innuendo?
Yeah, just one, I think.
I think I caught maybe two.
Yeah, there's a really hot precursor to Elvira in the film. I remember that. The monster, I think, is called Odd Bod. He's kind of this weird looking Wolfman Frankenstein thing.
And surely there were jokes about whatever cats and who owned them walking around the set.
I have a friend who constantly, and it's not funny if you can't see it, so I'm not going to do it, but I do a really good Kenneth Williams impersonation.
Come on.
Because I contort my face to look like him. And, you know, because do you remember Will-O-The-Wisp? It was a cartoon Kenneth Williams did in the 70s.
I know the title. I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, he was Will-O-The-Wisp, and he told stories about the characters in the forest. And anyways, I could do a really good impersonation of Kenneth Williams before I knew who Kenneth Williams was.
You're kind of throwing down the gauntlet there.
Yeah, but I can't. It's not funny. It's a visual. And
you know what? You know who played him in a TV biopic? Michael Sheen.
Oh, that works.
And he was wonderful. I mean, Sheen's really good. Sheen's played a lot of real people.
Sheen's a bit of a chameleon because
my
wife watches those Underworld movies, and she thinks he's
dreamy.
And then he goes on 30 Rock.
Yeah.
And he's Wesley Snipes, and he's just abhorrent. And I had to tell my wife, that's the guy you lust after in those werewolf movies. And she's like, no. You know,
I love him. I've loved him for a long time. I think he's great. But he plays Kenneth Williams, and it's an interesting biopic that was on British television.
I'd like to see it because there's a lot of checkered stuff in that guy's past.
Oh yeah, turns out he might have been gay.
That wasn't the thing I was thinking of, but shocker. I was thinking more or less that there was a homicide investigation with him. I'm not gonna let that out. But
no, there was some stuff. You should see this thing. It's very, very interesting. Okay, so carry on. So now we're getting toward the 70s, and
We got the Fearless Vampire Killers in there. Roman Polanski.
That's very goofy.
Yep.
But I think the real benchmark that kind of pushed it for a little bit of a revival was Young Frankenstein.
We forgot something before we get to that one. Television, 60s, Munsters and Addams Family.
Oh yeah, that's right. Well, we're kind of jumping around. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But those two, again, talk about the height of Monster Mania.
Yeah.
Were those two on the same network back to back?
No, they were on competing networks. The Munsters, you got Fred Gwynn and Al Lewis, hot from Car 54. Universal licensed makeup. In fact, Bud Westmore, who did Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, did the makeup on those shows.
Right.
You had characters like the Gill Man showing up as Uncle Gill.
Yep.
Like this was the highlight, the zenith of monster kidism in the 60s, you know?
It really was.
And then you got the Addams Family, which, I mean, the debate will rage on forever which show is better or funny.
Really? Is there really a debate?
I don't know, man. I think they're both funny.
I think they're both funny too.
Yeah.
But you say Desert Island, you can take either one. I'm taking Addams Family every time. I'm taking Addams Family. I'm sorry, because Munsters to me that's like Munsters is great and I love it and there's some clever stuff in there, but it's kind of like, how can I describe this? It's like Munsters is kind of the. There's something more subversive and weird and kinky and strange about the Addams Family.
I think it all depends on how you like your comedy, because the Munsters is very broad, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's what it is. And then Addams Family is a little more subversive, you know. And I think Mike Weldon of Psychotronic said once, Gomez and Morticia were the first adults I saw making out on TV.
I mean, and it's kinky.
Yeah,
I mean,
like they're really into each other.
They're really into each other. And by the way, tiny sidebar, two great films. The casting in both of those Addams Family movies with Raul Julia and Angelica Houston and Christopher Lloyd and everybody else is really kind of wonderful.
I actually don't really like them.
My daughter adores them. Gomez, John Astin is
John Astin. I love Carolyn Jones.
Just mental.
Then of course the Munsters even got a movie.
Yes, they did.
With Terry Munsters Thomas, because I think Munster Go Home.
Yep.
And it was weird to see them in color. Terry Thomas is in it because I think there was a court order that you had to put Terry Thomas in everything at one point. And it's a really good. I'm not that big a fan of the movie. I like the series better.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I love the Munsters. I mean, one of my favorite scenes from the Munsters is there's a guy picking on Herman at work. And of course Herman's got, you know, needs assertiveness training. And just before he's gonna give this guy a piece of his mind, somebody at work is standing in the break room with the guy and he said, "Why are you picking on Herman Munster?" And the guy goes, "Well, it's funny." And he goes, "Have you really looked at Herman Munster?" And they're looking at him down the street. And Herman's trying to cross the street, and there's two cars parked too close together. So he looks, and he just pushes the cars away. And it's a funny scene, you know, because the horror on the guy's face, like, this guy will tear me apart.
Well, am I wrong, or did Rickles and Harvey Korman show up in that show from time to time?
You know what? I wouldn't doubt it.
or maybe it was Adam's Family. But Adam's Family to me was more like the both of them were kind of like this creepy, weird sort of family at the center of each of them thinks what they're doing is totally fine and normal. And not only that, but they don't even they're not even really aware or acknowledging the fact that the outside world thinks differently.
And that's why those Brady Bunch movies in the 90s were a hit, because they took that model.
Yes, they did.
And it was beautiful. It was a great thing. You know, the fish out of water concept.
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing like just you know, and but I lean toward Adam's Family because of those two leads, and it's just a little more. I mean, remember, like every time he spoke French.
Yeah, no, there's no loser in this debate.
That's really kinky. That's really
it's wonderful, and I think they're both great. Now, before we get to Young Frankenstein, which I think is probably the penultimate 70s horror comedy, I wanted to talk a little bit about Amicus Films, who was a competitor to Hammer, and they were doing these great things like Tales from the Crypt, and they would, you know, these kind of, they're not, you know, they did the Monster Club and things like
right,
that.
Right.
Amicus always threw a lot of horror and schlock into their movies. Sorry, a lot of humor and schlock. So they're not as scary or as serious as Hammer.
Right.
So they're not outright comedies, but they're pretty funny at times.
They're funny. They're just, it's hard to categorize or figure out exactly what they are or what they're trying to be, because it's that fine line of being really kind of weird and underground and slightly strange, but very broad and very big.
And 73's Theater of Blood is a tour de force for Vincent Price.
Which one is, what's it called?
Theater of Blood.
Oh, is that the, with Diana Rigg.
With Diana Rigg. And there is nothing funnier than Vincent Price playing the Faye hairdresser with the big afro. Hi, I'm Butch.
Oh my God.
I mean, I could watch that all day.
If you had to pick, who was your favorite of any of the horror stars?
Oh God. No, I can't do that. I love Price. I love.
No wrong answer.
It would either be Cushing or Lee, and that doesn't really go to this episode because those guys weren't comedians per se. So that doesn't really work. But, I mean, nobody did humor like Price, if that makes
sense. He was also that fine line of – it's interesting. You know, these guys we're talking about – like you look at Rondo Hatton and you go, that's not a guy you want to walk in the room and have anything to do with. He's just scary looking, not his fault.
Yep.
But, you know, Karloff was a big guy, but he had a gentle voice. You know, Lugosi, whatever – Vincent Price. I mean, how did that guy? It's like some of his stuff is bordering on camp, the way he sort of played these characters and his voice. But he became this massive star in the horror world.
Yeah,
and synonymous for a long time. And he did a lot of other stuff too. But it's interesting that
he could play creepy pretty good. He was a good actor. I mean, I know a lot of it was a little tongue in cheek. Like the Fibes movies are kind of more. A little tongue in cheek, as opposed to something straight, but they're entertaining, and he's good in them. So,
yeah, no, he's great. So now we get past Amicus, and now we're up to what Brian already said is probably the best known, you know, horror comedy, scary comedy, whatever you want to call it, and that would be Young Frankenstein,
which is really just a send up of Universal Films, and it's done so lovingly and so well. And you know, did you see the musical?
I did not see the musical. I have the film. I love it. And if I'm a Mel Brooks guy, I'm a Mel Brooks guy with Gene Wilder. Like, Gene Wilder, I think, is one of the few comedic geniuses to ever live. And his performances in The Producers, especially, and Young Frankenstein are a thing to behold if no one's ever seen them. And I'll get to him in a second. But so this thing, I forget exactly where the concept came from or how it got sort of, you know, the boat got pushed out or whatever. But it was black and white. 1974, I think, and you know, the inception of it, I think, was Wilder's. I think he wrote it, or they were co-writers on it, but I think Wilder might have written the script, and it was really his thing. And because of the relationship that he already had with Mel Brooks, this all came together. But the sets in there, the set that they're on, Dr. Frankenstein's sets, his lab and everything, a lot of the stuff in that lab came right from Universal, from the old films.
Actually, it came the electrical stuff came from the home of Kenneth Strickfaden.
Or it came there via Kenneth Strickfaden's house.
Stuff
was used in the original things. So that's all happened. I mean, again, clearly to me, it's like one of the reasons I think Holy Grail, you know, for Python works so well, and Brian or whatever, but Grail, you go back and look at Grail, what little money that they had and the hardship that they went through lent itself so much to what they did, because it really feels like that's kind of what that time period would have looked like.
Yeah.
There's mud and dirt and fog and smoke and dead people and filth and all that stuff. And it's all comedy. It's everything about it is goofy and silly and absurd and sort of insane. And I remember seeing Wilder once on what was it, Actors Studio or something like that.
I think I watched him recently. This was recently?
Nah, it's about maybe 10, 12 years ago or something.
Okay, no. Well,
and he tells us
recent about, interview.
They talked about comedy or something, or whoever he was with, and how did he get there to do things so well comedically? And he's talking about how Charlie Chaplin was a hero of his. And he was saying that there was a Chaplin film where a big man is holding his, you know, 2-year-old son in his arm. Behind him is the tramp. He's standing on a corner or something, and this tramp's starving. He hasn't eaten in weeks, and the little boy has a hot dog. So when the father's looking forward, little boy's hot dog is in his hand. Chaplin leans in, takes a bite, starts chewing. The dad then looks down at the kid. Where'd that big chunk of hot dog go? Turns around to look at Chaplin. Chaplin stops chewing. And each time the dad turns around, he does this. And he goes, he said, Charlie Chaplin wasn't trying to be funny. He only knew that he was hungry. And the comedy came out of that. And you watch Wilder in this absurd comedy of Young Frankenstein. He goes off the rails. He does it goofy. But when he's – most of Wilder's comedy is playing it very straight.
Yeah.
And the absurdity comes from that. And it's a brilliant thing. And again, I will tell people about this whether they know it or not till the day I die. The one – probably the most famous bit out of the entire film is when he finally reveals the creature to the audience. They're in a theater and they do Puttin' on the Ritz. It's one of the most sublime comedic moments in the history of cinema. And Mel Brooks wanted nothing to do with it. Mel Brooks, Gene Wilder fought him till the end and said, this has to be in. And Brooks said, it's not funny. It's not funny. It's not going to be funny. I don't know why you're doing this. It doesn't work. Wilder fought for it, and it became this iconic, hysterical piece. Not just for the film, but for comedy in general. And I really, really love that movie. And Peter Boyle is the creature, and Madeline Kahn, the late, great Madeline Kahn. Yeah. There will never be another.
No.
Terry Garr, God, I mean, Marty Feldman. I mean, this right there, you're done. If you only had them in your film, you're done. But no, you get Kenneth Mars and Cloris Leachman as well.
Yeah.
Everybody in that thing is firing on all cylinders. And it is subversive and kind of dirty and goofy. And it's got as many goofy, you know, puns that are obvious as it has subtle stuff.
Saw it on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
Andrea Martin as Frau Blücher.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Who cared who anyone else was? Megan Mullally was the Madeline Kahn character, and she was awesome. But I was just there to see Andrea Martin.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. And then I thought about, you know, trying to get, you know, do the stage door thing. But, you know, I had a couple of pops, and I kind of thought that I'm going to come off odd. And I'm a large, intimidating fella. So
yeah, it's probably for the best.
Yeah.
That year
came out my favorite horror comedy. Well, I don't know if you'd call it a horror comedy, but Phantom of Paradise, which definitely has comedic elements to it.
So great, yeah.
And then
stop for a second. This is the Phantom of the Paradise. You could do a whole episode on that, just you, Brian. That's you could do it. It's such a weird, again, of its time. What the F?
Why
is
it failed is because it's hard to market.
Well, exactly, because it's not one thing or the other.
Nope.
Like, it's not like I'm not sure we can put an American Werewolf in London in here because it's so scary. And Landis always says, well, you know, this studio thought it was too funny to be a horror film, and the other one thought, but it's goofy, but it's not goofy in the same way as some of the stuff we're talking about. And Paradise is like, there's some really poignant, sad stuff in there, and the violence and everything else. And then you've got Beef.
Yeah, Garrett Graham.
Garrett Graham.
So fabulous in that movie.
Garrett, if that's the guy I want to meet. If I ever meet that guy. Yeah. And he was also in Chud. Remember he was in Chud?
Yeah, he was Chud too. He was Bud the Chud.
Bud the Chud.
It's not quite the same.
It's not quite the same. He takes that character and that whole thing completely somewhere else. His voice, everything, the gusto.
Garrett Graham is another guy that deserved a lot more acting.
He really did. And
he's really fantastic.
Well, because his contemporary, the people he worked with and for, one of the first things De Niro ever did, Hi Mom, and then the next one, Greetings.
Yeah.
Garrett Graham was in, directed by Brian De Palma. This one by Brian De Palma. He worked with Zemeckis on Used Cars. He was in, he was. You know, you thought that he would go. I don't know. I can't explain it. But he was brilliant. And do you ever know where what day or how it happened that someone said, yeah, you're doing the rock star thing, but this is how he sounds, or this is where the voice comes from. Did he choose to do that and take it someplace else, or was that sort of set up?
You know, I watched the Blu-ray recently, and I think he was, and forgive me if I'm wrong, because there's people out here who will kill me if I get this wrong. I think he really was the I think Beef was supposed to be a certain way, and then he camped him up, and it because really worked.
Yeah, I can't imagine the reaction from Brian De Palma saying, let's roll, or rehearse.
God, he's so funny in that.
And that thing comes out of him, and like, where did you – thank you for going there. It's just great because it's this big, you know, butch, beefy guy, clearly in the era of glam where everything was very androgynous anyway, and that voice comes out. And it's not quite –
he's really terrific on that underrated John Lovitz TV show, The Critic. He was the critic's dad, who was a drunkard.
Oh yes,
and he was so funny on that.
He's got a great voice. He's great. So we got those two. Then it gets a little quiet for a bit, right?
No, it doesn't. Still, the next year, what you happened? Got Rocky Horror.
See, but again, is that what is that?
You know what? I'm gonna go right out and say it. You can stone me. I don't like the Rocky Horror.
It's not like that. It's not that I hate it or dislike it. It doesn't make my skin crawl when I hear stuff. I've never been to the live thing. Never wanted to.
Yeah.
I've seen the movie. I think Tim Curry's fantastic. That's about all I can say about it. I don't know why, but some people prefer, you know, this to that. I don't know.
I know people that just swear by it, say it's the greatest thing ever. You know, when it came out on home video in '89, it was a big deal, and a lot of people say it ruined it. Because before then, you always had to see it in this theater environment where it was crazy, and I think I missed it. And I don't put down anybody that likes it. I've missed the boat. So.
Yeah, no, I don't quite get it. And I don't think it did well when it came out. It became this cult thing. I'm more fascinated by that, how the thing grew and why, and that's interesting. But then would you say from there we jumped to Love at First Bite?
No, actually, you forgot. And this is a controversial film. I saw this in the theater as a kid, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Oh, God.
Yeah, which is, you know, was funny to me when I was eight. But it's a purposeful send up of the genre.
Yeah,
I really did enjoy my time in the theater seeing it. It was like a famous movie came to town, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw it at the Brock Cinema as a kid, and you know, it's not something I plan to ever revisit.
I just remember being very schlocky and spoofy.
Yeah,
and
goofy. It's dumb as a post.
But that didn't again. So okay. Tell me when we get to Love at First Bite.
Well, now I think – now we're at Love – well, you could mention Piranha, but Love at First Bite is definitely the big horror comedy that ended the 70s. George Hamilton, Susan St. James?
Susan St. James.
Wasn't Artie Johnson Renfield?
Artie Johnson is Renfield. Wow. Richard Benjamin is her therapist slash
boyfriend.
Dick Shawn is in it.
Yeah.
Again, from Mel Brooks, from the producers,
yeah,
and lots of other things. Mad World.
Yeah.
Richard Benjamin. Sherman Helmsley has a cameo in it. And who's the other one? His wife? What's she called? Jefferson's? What was her name?
Oh, Wheezy?
Yeah, but her real name.
Elizabeth Sanford. Why did I know that?
No, it wasn't Elizabeth.
No.
No, you're right. No, that's not it. The Jefferson? The woman on the Jeffersons?
That was Elizabeth Sanford. Yes.
Was it?
Yes.
Wow. Well done. She's in it. Some others. It is, people. I had the photo novel, my very first issue of Famous Monsters, I think, in 78 or 79, was the cover with Love at First Bite. And I loved it. I saw it like my dad.
A little G-Force trivia?
I saw it three times.
You want a little G-Force trivia that'll blow your mind? Guy in Elevator is cast to Ronnie Schell. And Ronnie Schell was the voice of Jason on G-Force.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, well, is it?
Yeah, Ronnie Schell was a perennial. He was the guy that was, he did loads of sitcoms, and he just was always there. Also, I heard recently from someone, because I posted a picture of the cover of that Famous Monsters, because I got interviewed by Famous Monsters. Which
yeah, very cool.
And it made me think of it. And then someone commented on it and said, I recently revisited Love at First Bite, and when they get to the scene on the dance floor in the discotheque, I mean, there's nothing more 70s than George Hamilton as Dracula, Susan St. James in a disco, a light-up floor, dancing to I Love the Nightlife by Sam Peckinpah. What's her name? I Love the Nightlife. I like to
I'm gonna get
Gloria.
Gloria Gaynor?
Gloria Disco, whatever the hell her name was. I'll figure it out. Martha Ray. And I mean, you watch this thing and you can practically smell the cocaine that must have been.
Oh, yeah. But it's a great
film. He said he watched it, and it's not I Love the Nightlife. That song was not in the DVD that he watched. For some reason, that iconic None More Disco, that whole thing, that song, those two characters, discotheque, 1979, you couldn't get more 70s than that. And the song isn't there anymore on the DVD.
Yank it? Oh, wow.
I don't know. I don't know why that happened. But I love it. It's weird. There's a lot of dirty jokes in it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I would welcome watching it again, because I haven't seen it since I was a kid.
They get away with an awful lot in a PG film in 1979.
Doesn't a pimp stick a switchblade at Dracula and Dracula bends it?
Yes, bends it. I think the entire cast we're talking about, Richard Benjamin. Again, where are you, Richard Benjamin? We need you.
Yeah. He's hanging out with Robert Klein.
He steals that movie. Everything he does, however manic it is, he keeps it real, and he reacts to the madness and the strangeness around him, and he's brilliant in that movie. I think it's an underrated and sometimes forgotten film, and we've seen with some of these iconic characters and concepts and stuff, if you get it wrong, there's more of these that get it wrong than get it right.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. So that's 1979. Should we throw in American Werewolf in 1981?
No, I wanted to talk TV for a minute in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, please do.
We had these are four things I want to mention. Hilarious House of Frankenstein, the Canadian kids show that was a comedy. I'm obviously a huge fan of it. Most of the characters were played by Billy Van, another underrated performer who never got his due. He played the Count.
Is he Bob's brother?
No. He played the Count. He played the Wolfman. He played the Witch. He played the Librarian. Vincent Price was the host, began the show, but Billy Van played almost every other character except for Igor and a couple of others.
It was his thing, right? It was his concept, right?
Yeah, and he was a very talented guy.
Right.
And he's a great improviser. Like, they filmed all the Count scenes in one marathon session. And I was just watching it today, and there's stuff you don't see as a kid that you laugh at now. Like, he was throwing Christmas balls on the floor because Igor's decorating. He's going, get rid of this. He picks up a Christmas ball, and it makes this really elaborate smashing sound. And you can tell he's improv because he kind of makes a face. And he goes, boy, that was an expensive Christmas ball. And he goes back to doing what he's doing. And I laughed out loud because I realized that was not planned. It was not scripted. He's just making a little aside, I love that show. The second in my heart is the Monster Squad, which is the 70, not the 87 movie.
Right.
It's the 76 television series that had Stanley Ralph, I think Stanley Ralph Ross, I can't remember, from probably the original Batman series, wrote it. It had Fred Grandy.
Probably Grandy's best role.
Yeah, I agree. And Henry Pollack is Dracula. Buck Cartellian is the Wolfman. Buck Cartellian is famous for being, I think, one of the gorilla in Planet of the Apes with the hose and, the, you know, I think he was in all the Planet of the Apes films. He's great. It's just a fun spoof of the 66 Batman series, but they're monsters. So that's really where I got my monster love.
You can get that on. Can't you get the whole series on DVD right now?
It's actually expensive. Like, it's sold out, and then I think they reissued it recently.
So, oh, interesting. Okay.
If I can get this all together for Hallow's Eve, which I'm trying to, I'll post a link, but don't hold your breath. The other thing I wanted to bring up was that there's Happy Days always did a spooky episode.
Yep.
And one of my favorites is the one, I think it's the first season. I like the first season of Happy Days.
Sure.
Where the
whatever happened
haunted
to Chip?
House.
What happened to Chip, by the way?
Chuck,
whatever happened to him?
He was one of the... You ever want to see what happened to Chuck? Rent Death Wish 3. Chuck plays the lead of this gang of road warriors that seem specifically there so Charles Bronson kills them. It is the greatest piece of shit film. You know, it's such a Reagan era, like somebody's racist grandpa wrote it.
Is that the thing where they were doing stuff like in a neighborhood?
Yeah.
Neighborhood? Baddies? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the neighborhood of, you know, it's a predominantly white gang with these road warrior marks, and they've all got, you know, cartoonish nicknames, and it's just the weirdest idea of what, you know, and they just seem to be, boy, we are trailing, they just seem to be basically ducks with targets on them. So
I think the street that they lived on was called Cliche Street.
Yeah. Oh boy, is this a piece of crap? And of course, it's a canon film, so it's awesome. But Chuck is the lead.
I've seen that. That's like, I'm going to say that's like 1985. I want to say
85 or 86.
Yeah,
it's a guilty pleasure of mine. If it's on TV, I tell my wife to go to bed.
It's like, why do I even know that?
Yeah,
like I couldn't tell a Bronson. You know the. Bronson's, you know, this from Death Wish 3, and I think that was 1985 or 86, I think.
So, you know what? The 80s are wonderful when you're talking about flops, because you have so many horror comedies in the early 80s. American Werewolf in London in 81 is probably the biggest highlight of the year, but you have The Funhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Bruce Funhouse. You have The Munsters' Revenge, which is a TV movie trying to revise the spirit of the Munsters.
That was in color, the first time I think we saw him in color,
no,
right?
No, that was Munster Go Home. But
that was in color?
Yeah. You probably saw it on black and white TV.
Probably.
I downloaded The Munsters' Revenge for the kids, and I put it on for a car ride about 2 years ago, and I was apologizing to them by the end of it. Saturday the 14th, speaking of Richard Benjamin.
Oh, my God, I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
Star, he and Paul Apprentice, was
Paul
it?
Paul Apprentice, yeah.
It's his wife.
Yeah, it was a total flop.
Oh, I remember
do you remember Student Bodies?
Oh, yes, of course. I'll let you know, like, a little confession. The reason my cousin and I rented it was because someone said that you could see boobies in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you do, eventually.
There, but for the grace of God, go I, sir. So, yeah.
What about Creepshow? What is Creepshow?
Creepshow is 82, and it's, you know, it's probably the best from when I'm looking at this list of horror comedies. You've got things like Hysterical, which was the Hudson's Brothers attempted a horror comedy, you know, your favorite and mine, the Hudson Brothers.
Boy, it was called Hysterical?
It was called Hysterical.
Listen, you better be, that's like, you know, the Cedric the Entertainer. You better be entertaining. If you're gonna walk around and call yourself Hysterical, you better be, in one way or another, you better do what it says on the tin.
It's not that funny. I saw it in 83 on pay TV.
Hudson Brothers.
Jekyll and Hyde together again. Do you remember Mark Blankfield?
Yes. In fact, when I was living in Toluca Lake, I think is when I saw – yeah, Toluca Lake.
Yeah.
Way back. When, you know, this is like late 90s kind of thing.
Yeah, he was the Belushi of Fridays.
He was, and I would bump into him at Vaughn. I mean, I never talked to him, but I would see him up at the Vaughn's up the street.
Oh, really?
And he was kind of the one big breakout of Fridays, like you said, which, you know, of course, Larry David came from and yeah, Mike and, Richards and all that Richards. Stuff. But his, again, none more 1980-81 character as the pill-popping pharmacist guy that was always jittery.
He was, yeah, and then he did, and this was what Jekyll and Hyde together again was. I think yeah. I think he got his powers from cocaine.
Yes.
I just watched that film. I found it on YouTube, and I watched the whole thing. There's one kind of semi-racist joke that made me laugh, but it made me laugh in that, like, oh, you couldn't get away with that now. And the rest of it is not funny.
It's kind of like, I know this is a huge cliche, and it's ridiculous to kind of, at this point, to even try to make fun of it, but what's the one, Can't Stop the Music?
Yeah.
You know, it's like some of these things that, you know, that are of their time, but there's no one around in the room going, look, let's just stop putting every reference. Don't get the Where's the Beef Lady in here, because in a year or two or whatever.
What are you saying? Moving Violations wasn't funny?
No. And but they managed to get the beef thing in there and the cocaine, all that stuff. And there's some of those where you can just archaeologists years from now will be blindfolded with no information and they'll look at a scene and go, I'm going to say that's like 81. Yep. 79, yep. 80, 81, somewhere.
This is the pre-Dr. Detroit era.
Yeah, it's like some of these things that are they're dated the day they shoot the scene.
They just like, come out and poof.
Yeah, like Can't Stop the Music was dated when they were making it. Like it was never going to be, and every bit of that is there's such madness going on in the concept of that, and then this the Jekyll and Hyde thing with the coke, and it's like, oh my god, what were we thinking?
It's pretty crappy. And then, you know, there were so many parodies of slasher films, right? You had National Lampoon's Class Reunion, Slumber Party Massacre, Microwave Massacre.
Wait, that was with the guy from Godfather 2 and
– Jackie Vernon, yeah.
No, not Jackie Vernon.
Jackie Vernon is the star of God. I just watched Microwave Massacre. It's
the guy with the bad skin and the mustache –
I don't know who you're talking about.
What's the movie called? Microwave Massacre?
Microwave Massacre.
And the character's called Mike Rowave, right?
Oh, God, I hope not.
What am I thinking of?
Jackie Vernon was the voice of Frosty the Snowman.
Okay, then it's not him.
I don't know what you're thinking of.
I'm going to look it up. It's my time.
Yeah.
So you keep talking now.
So I think the big... You know, talking about the 80s, you can't not mention Ghostbusters.
To me, that's the high watermark of the 80s.
Yep. Obviously. I would say so.
Let's get there real quick because, I mean, I know the world knows Ghostbusters and everybody loves it, but the Ghostbusters film, Ghostbusters, would have been a very different thing when it was first sort of happening and Ackroyd was putting it together. It was much scarier than there was comedy.
Yep.
And, you know, he and Ramis banged that thing together. Ramis was a genius.
There's nothing. I have nothing bad to say about Harold.
He was an absolute genius on camera.
Yep.
He was a genius behind as a director, as a writer. Most people can only really – they're really, really good at one thing.
Yeah.
To be really good at like several different departments and things is like genius. And he banged that thing into shape. Originally – one of the Ghostbusters was going to be Belushi.
Yeah.
That's how far back that goes.
Yeah, no, it was a script that went around for a long time. And unfortunately, some Dan Aykroyd scripts got made. like Nothing But Trouble.
Yes, but which was originally called
Vulcanvania.
That's right.
Yeah. I can remember every scene from that movie.
I know. It's just a big steaming pile of shit.
It is.
But also, John Candy would have been the Rick Moranis character, but apparently he couldn't get his mind around – he wanted the guy to have a couple of dogs, like Dobermans.
Yeah.
And he insisted, and then Ramis was like, it just doesn't work, whatever. For all a bunch of other reasons – you know, Murray helped get that thing made.
Yeah.
Bill Murray had such clout with the studios because of Stripes and, you know, he was in Tootsie and Meatballs did really well, etc.
Razor's Edge.
Razor. No, that was after you goof.
I know.
But he really did put that together and made that happen. And Aykroyd always said that if it weren't for Bill Murray, etc. But
can I be a knob and say I still don't understand the rampant fandom and cosplay for a movie I quite enjoy? I'll never understand it.
For which movie?
Ghostbusters.
Because you know why? I'll tell you. Because it's brilliant. It is one of the script for Ghostbusters, the comedy
it's
itself.
Funny as hell.
Pound for pound. But it's just to me, it's like, you know, it's like a Back to the Future.
Yeah. Don't get me started.
No. Not the other two. I think Back to the Future is a fucking Swiss watch. That script is really tight, and there's a lot of smartness and jokes and cleverness and everything. But Ghostbusters, I mean, you have to buy it. Like, you have to. These guys are giving it their all. I mean, this wasn't something that was done every day. They're, like I said, they're rare. You got Aykroyd, who's really a believer, who really
– Oh, yeah. You know, no, you don't have all that stuff.
And Murray said at the time when it came out, he said, I think one of the reasons it works the way it does, or it will work, he said, and that you'll love the funny so much, is that it's so damn scary.
You know,
and,
what? You know, we're all friends here. I think it's a great film. I'm not going to argue. I just don't get the insane –
Is there a lot of people dressing like? I must run into chapters. I don't even get the whole cosplay thing. I mean,
yeah,
I just looked at a thing for the kamikaze thing that's going to be here, the Stan Lee thing.
Yeah.
And they listed the guests that are going to be at this thing, and by the time you get down to the last category, it's cosplayers.
Yeah.
Like,
but they are a draw, and I don't get it myself, but they are a draw, and I don't really have, other than I sometimes interrupt their photos because I'm trying to get from point A to point B.
I'll say it again. I've said it before. I'll put it on the record. What causes congestion and traffic and takes you twice as long at all cons, but especially like something like Comic-Con? It's the cosplayers. It's everyone wanting to take pictures and stopping traffic. It's the 405 of the conventions. They're killing it. They're killing everybody's. But I didn't know there was a lot of it, but I just think it's a very, very funny movie. It's iconic.
No, I've got nothing against the film. I just don't
After Ghostbusters 84, which was, you know, mega massive, did it sort of like
there was lots of kicks at the can after this.
Monster Squad, is that the next kind of thing?
No, I'd say you've got Fright Night.
Fright Night's a good that holds up pretty well.
Reanimator, which is an excellent dark Reanimator, comedy.
That's just twisted. That's
Return of the Living Dead, which I think is a very funny movie.
Very funny.
Larry Cohen's The Stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's subversive. There's a lot of subversive.
Like, a lot of these are dark and they're not as commercial as Ghostbusters or Transylvania 65,000, which I love. Not only because Gina Davis in that vampire outfit was a 14-year-old boy's memory. The other thing I really like about it is they teamed John Biner and Carol Kane together. And it's she's really funny in that movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the two leads were Jeff Goldblum
and Ed Begley, and they're surprisingly very good together.
Yeah, they're no. They're,
so, they didn't, so Hollywood went, never again.
Never again. You guys were such a great team. We're never doing it again.
And then a year later, we've got From Beyond, which is from the Reanimator people. I don't know if that's really that funny to be.
I don't think it's. I think Reanimator is really attempting to be funny much more than From Beyond. And I'd even argue kind of not Living Dead, but what was the one you said? I'm not sure if Fright Night.
No, Fright Night has its laugh fest, though. You're right.
Absolutely. But it's kind of more knowing, and I think it's more it's actually pretty scary.
It's got some good parts in it.
There's some really good
stuff. I would actually go back and say I don't think Fright Night belongs on this list.
You're fired.
Clicking along, because I know we've both got to get places here, is Haunted Honeymoon with Gene Wilder and Gilda Radner.
Ooh, no. Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Oh my God! I forgot about it. So it's Wilder, Gilda Radner, and
Dom DeLuise.
Oh, Dom DeLuise
in drag, I believe. Yeah. I have never seen it.
I've seen it many years ago. But was that around the time of High Spirits?
High Spirits, I think, was 87 or 88. 88.
Why do I know that?
You know what? I was sitting here somewhere and I was looking at a picture of Peter O'Toole and I was like, did I see a movie where Steve Guttenberg is a ghost? What is? And it all came back. I saw it on a date, like in '88. And
the thing is, as a pitch, as an idea, it's actually a pretty funny concept for comedy that this hotel, you know, takes advantage of people being attracted to the history of it, says it's haunted, gets people to go, you know, try to become guests there, and then fakes all the haunting stuff, and then the real ghost. But the cast now, you look at it, Peter O'Toole, Steve Guttenberg, I think Liam Neeson's in it, I think.
Maybe. Daryl Hannah?
Daryl Hannah, that's right.
Yeah.
And it's directed by, I think, Neil Jordan.
Who did
The Crying Game. And
I saw it once.
It doesn't work. But
we missed a few here. '86 had the big remake of Little Shop of Horrors, which probably should have done better than it did, but I think it's well remembered.
Right.
You had stuff like Night of the Creeps, the not so great Terror Vision. '87 was two really seminal horror comedies came out. Maybe three if you're certain. Bad Taste, Peter Jackson's film. I love Bad Taste.
Yeah. That was '87?
Yeah. Evil Dead 2.
Oh, yes, of course.
Slapstick and horror.
But don't you would you agree that the Raimi tone and the Bruce Campbell sort of tone and Amen, I hope, do you have Stars? I mean, the network.
No.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I have torrents though, so I
Tomorrow night is the premiere of Ash versus Evil Dead, and I could not be more excited about this thing. Because wouldn't you agree that for me, it's like, you know, Evil Dead 2 is the road warrior to Evil Dead. You know what I'm saying? And I think that that's where it really kicked off. Evil Dead's got goofy stuff in it and scary, you know, kind of
Evil
weird.
Dead 2 is a wonderful reimagination.
Yes, and it's more flat out funny, don't you think?
Yeah, and it just, you know, it gets better and better. I love Army of Darkness.
Oh, I love it.
I don't count the Monster Squad from '87 as a horror comedy. I don't think it's that funny.
I think it's got some really good stuff in it. I don't have a love for it like people do.
It's too adult for kids and too kiddy for adults. Like, I don't know what it wants to be.
Yeah, but remember, I was in the theater for the re-release of Young Frankenstein. My dad took me to Love at First Bite. There's jokes about weed.
I know
hickeys and weird stuff like that. So it's, you know, so these things had different tones that. You know, would I tell a kid, you know, 9-10-year-old to go watch Love at First Bite? Maybe not, but it didn't really do me any harm.
Or did it? Beetlejuice has to be 88's.
Beetlejuice,
high point.
I want to get to. Thank you.
Yeah.
Again, I'm sorry. I don't know enough about the history. I know a lot about Beetlejuice. I don't quite know enough of who it was that said, oh, yeah, let's go ahead and make this insane, completely mental idea of a movie. I mean, really, you watch that again and you go, and it did well when it came out. It got word of mouth and it started to grow and people really were attracted to that character. But it wasn't like it was a worldwide kind of hit. But it made its money back and it did well and it made a pretty good profit. And
I sent my boss to it and I thought he was going to kill me the next day. He the entire summer. He's like, well, yeah, you're the guy who made me go see that stupid horror movie.
Wow.
He hated it. He hated it.
I mean, again, there's some really, again, not for guys like you and I, but there's some scary, dark stuff in that movie. And it's very, it's kind of cynical. It's very, it has some
it's
sweetness
beautiful.
In it.
My daughter loves it.
I adore that movie. You know how much I love Michael Keaton. And I'm going to say this now on air. I'm going to say this right now. I don't know what they're doing. I think there's very, 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 very strong talk that another Beetlejuice film is going to happen. And Michael Keaton has said all these years the only character he'd be keen on coming back and playing again is Beetlejuice. Burton wants to do it. A script is there. The concept is there, etc. Winona Ryder, I think, is back in, whatever. If somehow this doesn't involve Beetlejuice somehow getting a chance to come and live in the land of the living – and blend in and do whatever, then I'll be disappointed. Because in the climate right now, to get a guy like that, either into politics, whatever it might be, where he shows up and just spins the, you know, spins the top and see what happens, it would be genius to me, because it's just let Keaton off the leash and you're gonna get gold.
My favorite scene in Beetlejuice, and it's just a little scene.
Oh, okay.
It makes me laugh every time, and it's Keaton. It's just the way, the crassness. You know, Baldwin's dressed like Mr. Plaid.
Yep.
And then Beetlejuice is wearing the exact same outfit. And he just goes, "Look, we shop at the same store." And it's just, I don't know why I think that's so funny, but
that
I
love,
laugh
and
every
I love,
time.
There's about three little tiny moments that I love. One of them is when he goes, I don't know how much was on the page and how much Burton kind of said, "This is what I think," and how much was just, was it 50% Keaton? Was it 50? Keaton is just off the rails in this movie. Like, where did
he's the Willy Wonka of the movie.
He really is. And in fact, the original cut of that film, the scene that one of the scenes I love, I'm about to mention, in the waiting room at the end.
Yeah.
Keaton is holding the number that he's the next person to be called, which is like, you know, 4 feet long.
4 billion, yeah.
And he turns to look at – he looks at it and then looks up at the number, and it's only on like number 4.
Yeah.
And he does this like slump of like, oh, with his head and everything, I think is genius.
Yeah.
He does another thing where he says he's tiny. And Winona Ryder's talking to him, and she says, "What happened to so and so? They're dead." And then he goes, "Dead ski." That's I love that, and I love it when he's giving his resume. They ask the sort of things that he's done about, and then my all time favorite is the very end, the climax. He's now in the land of the living, gets rid of the two of them, spotlights on him. He's in this shitty tux with a cigarette, and he's like, thank you. And then he stops and says, "And that is why I'll never do two shows in one night. I won't do it. And he flicks the cigarette and then gets right back to business. There's no way that could have been scripted. And I mean, that kind of improv and Keaton's choices and stuff, I just adore that film. I know it backwards and forwards. And if it's ever on, I can't stop. So that scene at the very end that was tacked on with Beetlejuice came out of preview screenings, and everyone said, "We want more of that character." That wasn't in the original cut.
Oh, really?
And Burton had to go back and shoot that with him in that waiting room, and that's how much they wanted to see this guy again. So
that's great.
I think it's all down to Keaton, really. But
kind of wrap up here. But
yes, what do we got?
I want to do one more film because I love it, and yeah. I love the actress. Elvira made a movie in 1988. Which should have been bigger. It was called Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. I had to take a train for an hour to see it in the closest theater.
Wow.
And I was a fan back then. I still am a fan. I mean, she looks amazing nowadays. It's a campy film, just like she is, but it was a great vehicle for her. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, I think I saw it either on home video or was like a perennial sort of cable thing in the late 80s, maybe?
And just to finish the 80s off, let's talk about The Burbs.
The Burbs, man. The Burbs is one of those things. I'll admit this to you flat out. I was so excited to see that thing when it came out. I enjoyed it. It was right after Big. I think Hanks did Big. It wasn't – I didn't think much of it. And then it wasn't until years later, catching it again on television, you watch that thing again, and it is, again – so subversive. It is. This is a big Hollywood studio movie.
Yeah.
Joe Dante, Tom Hanks, Carrie Fisher, Bruce Dern, all these people. I don't know what they thought this thing was going to be or how big it was going to be, but it is mental. Like, it is like there is so much creepy, weird, subversive shit in there.
Yeah. I don't understand how it got made.
I really
don't.
It
did.
Me too.
Really a great showcase. Sadly, he just didn't go anywhere, and he passed away. Canadian comedian and Rick DeCommon. He hosted a kids' show here called Zigzag.
He died.
Yeah, and
brilliant in The Burbs. I thought, because I'll never forget. You want to go weird and get really obscure? The E channel here, E Entertainment News, used to be called Movie Time. In 1989, when it launched. Briefly, and I remember live, I think it was, maybe it was taped, Duke DeCommon hosting like a 2-hour thing in between commercials and stuff or whatever it was to talk about the summer movies and stuff. And his, and then eventually he's holding his kid, like his baby or something, and he's riffing and improvising, and he was so good and so funny.
Yeah, he was an underrated talent. He just didn't get around much.
He just didn't. And when that movie came out, I thought, that guy's going to be a big star because he steals movies. And going back and watching it again, Tom Hanks is wonderful in it. He, again, playing it real and reacting to all the madness. Everyone else is completely off the rails, big characters, except for like Carrie Fisher. And he holds it together, and he's so good in it. And it's not a happy ending.
Nope.
I mean, it's really creepy.
The Naps are dead.
Really weird. It's very, very strange. We can't end with the Burbs. What's come out like in the past decade?
We got to end with one. Let's just end the 80s. We can come back to this subject. I want to bring up Parents by Bob Balaban.
Wow. But see, that's
a weird movie.
I'm sorry. Each of us gets to throw one Trump card in, I'm going to jump in and go, I can't explain it. Like Alligator is not a monster movie. It's a creature feature.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same thing. So like, I know that movie. That's a great movie.
It's a weird movie.
It's really, really, really strange. Really weird. I don't want to give anything away but let's just say that it's the 50s, right?
Yes, it's a really skewed child's view of the 50s, yeah.
So you're not sure sometimes what's what, and the little boy in it, and the alcohol, and all these weird things. But it's not – you know, the stuff that's in there that's funny is dark, and they're aware that it's a dark comedy. But I'm not sure if it's a comedy. Well, I don't know what you call it when it's like –
black comedy, I guess.
Yeah, it's more of like a black comedy to me than necessarily a horror comedy.
Fair enough. Yeah,
so that's you know, and so I would, and so like American Werewolf, it's definitely a horror movie, but and there's funny stuff in it.
There's a lot of laughs, yeah.
But there's much, much more horror than I think there is than
I think it gave me nightmares when I saw it. I may have been like 11, so bear with me. But yeah, it scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, so. Did we not get anything like that in the 90s or the 2000s?
Well, I'm sure we did, but you know, it seems like a long list to go through.
No, we don't have to go through all of them. But like, what can you think of something of recent memory, like the past 10 years?
I love Army of Darkness. I consider that a comedy.
Yep.
This is not going to be great because, like, I don't like things that are like Scary Movie and stuff. That's just okay.
No. Those to me are. Spoofs, rather than comedies. So, all right. I really liked
Bubba Hotep and Eight-Legged Freaks.
That was okay. I'll tell you what. I'll throw in my card.
Oh, yeah, I know what yours is going
to
be.
And you tell me whether you think this is a good thing to wrap it up on. And that would be Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
Written by Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright. Goes back to us talking.
We would be remiss in not mentioning that.
Exactly. However. And maybe I'm giving a caveat to my own suggestion. I prefer Hot Fuzz. I'm not going to lie. I think Hot Fuzz, of the three that they did, I love all three of them. I think Hot Fuzz is perfection.
Oh, really?
For many reasons, the script, the comedy in it, the premise, etc., the performances, and the cavalcade of amazing British actors they got to be in that thing. From you know Edward Woodward to Timothy Dalton to you name it.
They did good that way.
They really did, and they brought in Hammer stuff, and they brought in references things, and like the Wicker Man and all those things. However, I think, and there's a fine line again. Is it funny to see the zombie's head come off with this, or is this guy gives a bite, or the little clues that are dropping in throughout the film that you pick up later, or the stepdad and all that? But I think it crosses the line. It crosses the line in the scene in the pub with what's his name with the rifle on Sean's mom when she's now going to turn eventually.
Oh yeah, okay.
That to me is too far.
That's your time out.
And I saw that in the theater in London because I was working on a show for like 4 or 5 weeks and I was kind of living in London. And I was so anxious. I saw it. I'm laughing with my – I'm just laughing my ass off. when that thing came, I my stomach started to turn. Like, I thought, there's going to be a joke here somewhere. We're going to wrap this up. Do you feel – I've argued this with people. Do you feel that took it too far away from the comedy horror thing?
Somebody always dies in a Disney film. I think you just have to take your laughs with your tears.
You're such a liar. Come on. The guy's got a shotgun aimed at Sean's mother's skull. You already know she's going to die. They're crying. They're emotional. He wants to kill. Does he kill her? No, yeah. He does. Sean does?
Yeah.
So Sean does. That's really crossing a line. And I think that they were so close to it and so they loving it. Even I even go so far as to say that Dylan Moran's demise takes it too far. Like, that turned my stomach when that happened. I know that they're horror fans, they love zombie stuff, etc. That takes me that much farther out of the comedy.
Yeah.
So I think that it's just about perfect, but it can cross a line. And
I'll tell you right now, as we wrap up here, it doesn't look like the genre is going anywhere. 2014 looks like there's about 20 films that came out. 2015, there's about 17 films listed.
Oh.
So horror comedy is here to stay. It's bigger than ever, and I think that has a lot to do with, you know, popularity of horror right now, and particularly zombies. Not all of these will be memorable or good, but you know what? Maybe we missed one on our Facebook page. Please tell us some of your favorite horror comedies. Share YouTube links. Let's get a discussion going.
Yeah, come on, do something, will you? And also, I'd love to hear what people think qualifies and doesn't, which is kind of what we did with the monster thing, top 10 monster choices. Did we do? Is that what we did, monster choices last year?
Yep.
Was that a year ago?
That was a year ago. It feels like yesterday.
Good gravy. Where we were saying, is Jaws a monster or a creature feature? It's a creature feature, right? No, it's a creature feature. It's not a monster movie.
No, you're right. It's not a monster movie.
Alligator
would be because we don't have giant alligators.
Or do we?
Well, that could be. I've seen them.
If we have the chud down there, who knows? What are they eating? They got to be eating alligators.
Could be.
Stands to reason.
Or they could be eating more people.
I'm curious what people think is sort of misses the mark or is weird. Like, there's always bits of, you know, the next, you know, serious vampire thing you see, or the next, there's always elements, there's a joke or two or a riff on something or a knowing kind of wink, which is not the same as a balance to me. So it's a very precise thing, or maybe I'm just being too geeky.
You know what? No, I think you're not. You can't be. Well, I guess you could be a comedy nerd, but
you know what we should do next if we're going to do something like this is horror type things in music.
You know, the Cramps. Oh yeah, okay. The Cramps.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
The Cramps. The Cramps. The Misfits.
King Diamond. You've got all his records, right?
The Misfits. The Monster.
We're going to have to get my buddy's death metal.
The Monster Mash. Well, you know what? On second thought, maybe the monster horror thing in music. Maybe we'll save that for next year.
I guess we could talk about Alice Cooper and
Alice Cooper. Alice Cooper,
the biggest monster horror, and ostensibly even Kiss. But
I mean, Iron Maiden's got a monster. Kiss love horror stuff.
Everybody had to have their own, you know, Vic Rattlehead. No,
yeah, that's what we'll do. Next one, maybe Rita Coolidge.
Get my jean jacket, Rita Coolidge. Yes.
Maybe that's the next thing that we do. And
anyways,
who sang Bela Lugosi's "Dead"?
Bauhaus.
Bauhaus. There you go. There's an episode. I'm writing this stuff as I go.
Yeah. We'll forget.
Well, thanks,
it
everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Watch a horror movie tonight. Happy Halloween.
Yeah, and just some useful tips. Don't eat all your candy in one go. Don't sit down and have all of it right away.
Now you tell me.
Save it, you know, and mix in the stuff you don't want. Mix it in early because you're going to get to the end and go, I didn't want any of this stuff. So, you know, figure it out, people, and have a great Halloween and enjoy scary stuff. Be safe and, you know, all that jazz.
See you in 30, folks.
Bye.